Hello, everybody, and welcome to The Death of Death. I'm your host, Nick Stewart, and today we're looking at the issue of idolatry in an apologetic framework. No business to get to today, so I think we can just jump into the show. Dottie, clear my schedule. I've got a guest before me. How's it going? You look great today. Let's get into this. I'm on my fifth read-through of the Bible this year. I don't mean fifth this year. I mean this year I'm on my fifth read. I couldn't read it five times in 1 year, I don't think. But I somehow never noticed the weight of this chapter before reading through the Bible this time. Or if I did, I didn't, you know, remember it or note it at all. But Isaiah 44. Isaiah is warning Israel about the destruction of Jerusalem and the exile to Babylon. The theme of purifying fire is used throughout the book to image the purifying effect the destruction is going to have. I wrote a blog for The Death of Death about that very theme in 2018, and I'll link to it in the show notes if you're interested in reading more, but the theme of purifying fire throughout Isaiah's book. But the theme of idolatry is strong in Isaiah because it was Israel's most egregious sin. Some say that God eventually cured Israel's compulsion toward idolatry because in the books that record Israel coming out of exile, like Nehemiah and Ezra, there seems to be lacking any mention of that particular sin. It's not something the New Testament addresses a lot either, at least by name, but I disagree. I think after the exile, Israel's idolatry was redirected toward statism. The Jews cry out, "We have no God but Caesar," as they ask the state to execute Jesus. I think it's safe to say that their idolatry was alive and well in the first century. Just placed on a more tangible system than a piece of wood. But at the time of Isaiah's writing, he's dealing with people actually making little idols of wood and worshiping them. And in chapter 44, so in verses 6 through 8, it says, "Thus says the Lord, the King of Israel, and his Redeemer, the Lord of hosts, I am the first and I am the last. Besides me, there is no God. Who is like me? Let him proclaim it. Let him declare and set it before me, since I appointed an ancient people. Let them declare what is to come and what will happen. Fear not, nor be afraid. Have I not told you from of old and declared it? And you are my witnesses. Is there a God besides me? There is no rock, I know not any." So God starts out by just stating the facts. I'm the first and the last. Besides me, there is no God. This is not an argument we can engage with and have a spirited debate about. This isn't a disagreement with quote-unquote good people on both sides. This is a statement of fact from the mouth of God himself. It goes on to say in verse 9, "All who fashion idols are nothing, and the things they delight in do not profit. Their witnesses neither see nor know, that they may be put to shame." Remember in verse 8, God calls his elect his witnesses. Now he's contrasting them with the witnesses of the idols and their foolishness. So their witnesses neither see nor know. Verse 10, "Who fashions a god or casts an idol that is profitable for nothing? Behold, all his companions shall be put to shame, and the craftsmen are only human. Let them all assemble, let them stand forth. They shall be terrified, they shall be put to shame together." So in verse 8, God told his elect to fear not. And here in verse 11, he's saying the ones who fashion idols will be terrified and put to shame. So another interesting contrast between the followers of idols and the followers of the true God. Verse 12, "The ironsmith takes a cutting tool and works it over the coals. He fashions it with hammers and works it with his strong arm. He becomes hungry and his strength fails. He drinks no water and is faint." So ironically, the ironsmith is making a god, but he himself isn't even powerful enough to go without food. He's faint. Verse 13, the carpenter stretches a line, he marks it out with a pencil, he shapes it with planes and marks it with a compass, he shapes it into the figure of a man with the beauty of a man to dwell in a house. So he's making gods in his own image, which is a contrast to God making man in his image. Another use of irony here, because the carpenter is making a god, it's supposed to be an omnipotent deity, and yet it's made in the image of this human being, a human being that can't even go without food or water without fainting. In verse 14, he cuts down cedars, or he chooses a cypress tree or an oak and lets it grow strong among the trees of the forest. He plants a cedar and the rain nourishes it. So without the true God, this wouldn't be possible. The man is relying on things made by God in order to create abominations against God. He's waltzing into God's creation and cutting down a tree that never would have grown without God giving it the rain. Verse 15, then it becomes fuel for a man. He takes a part of it and warms himself. He kindles a fire and bakes bread. Also, he makes a god and worships it. He makes it an idol and falls down before it. Half of it he burns in the fire. Over the half he eats meat. He roasts it and is satisfied. Also, he warms himself and says, aha, I am warm. I have seen the fire. And the rest of it he makes into a god, his idol, and falls down to it and worships it. He prays to it and says, deliver me, for you are my God. Half of the wood he uses correctly. He uses it to cook his food and to warm himself. He's relying on God's creation to nourish him. But the other half he creates into a false god and asks it to deliver him. So God has already delivered him to an extent by warming him and giving him warm food through the wood. But after regaining his wits about him, you know, because he faints when he doesn't eat. So after, getting his wits back, the carpenter turns to the idol that he made and asks it to deliver him. Verse 18, they know not, nor do they discern, for he has shut their eyes so that they cannot see, and their hearts so that they cannot understand. So God gives people over to their sinful desires and makes them blind. It takes a spiritual, sovereign act of God to open those eyes and those hearts. Verse 19, no one considers, nor is there knowledge or discernment to say, half of it I burned in the fire, I also baked bread on its coals, I roasted meat and have eaten, and shall I make the rest of it an abomination? Shall I fall down before a block of wood? He feeds on ashes, a deluded heart has led him astray, and he cannot deliver himself or say, is there not a lie in my right hand? Notice it's not a deceiving friend who leads him astray, or a depraved culture. It's not the public school system, although you all know that I'm not a fan of that. No, it's his own deluded heart that leads him astray. He can't recognize that he's living a lie by doing this. So this is just like what we've been talking about in the realm of apologetics. People use the things of God given to them to create abominations. They use reason and logic to conclude that God doesn't exist, but they never would have had those things if God hadn't granted it to them in the first place. So we use the wood of reason and logic to warm ourselves and cook our food, but then we take whatever remains of it and we use it in ways that are unimaginable and make no sense. So we use logic and reason to, you know, rely on the ignition of our car working and rely on our vocal cords making noises when we speak, but we take logic and reason, whatever's left over, and we say there's no God, or we say there's no truth, or we say that, you know, a man can be a woman. So that's why almost every sin is a misuse or a distortion of something good that God has given us. The truth is a good thing God gives us and allows us to know, but then we go and we say the opposite of the truth in order to control a situation, and we've distorted the good thing God gave us. We lied. We used the opposite of the truth. Sex is a good thing that God gave us, but any sexual sin is a distortion of its proper use. Property is a good thing that he gives to us, but then we covet and steal someone else's property, and now we're misusing it, and it's a sin. So a deluded heart wreaks havoc on man's interaction with God's creation. A deluded heart is what takes it from using half the wood for warmth and cooking to using the other half to form an idol. The deluded heart takes it from doing a good deed for God's glory and the good of your neighbor to doing it for your own glory and the way it makes you feel to do something good for someone. So we should do what Isaiah does. We should point out the folly in using half the wood for an idol. We should point out the folly of using logic, reason, observation. These are all gifts of God to conclude that he doesn't exist. It's like the jail cell analogy I used a couple episodes ago. You're in a jail cell in the dark, and you've always been there. Someone feeds you three times a day, but you never see them. One day they leave you a key and a flashlight with your food, so you turn on the flashlight and use the key to open your cell door. You climb up the stairs to the lobby, and you don't see anyone. So that must mean there never was a jailer, right? No. If there wasn't a jailer, you wouldn't have been fed three times a day, and you never would have gotten that key and the flashlight and, you know, those things that you used to get to the lobby. You know, you used all the things the jailer gave you to ultimately conclude that he doesn't exist, and that's just laughable. It doesn't make any sense. So one thing we must always do when we're doing apologetics is to point out the absurdity of a universe without God. Sometimes you'll be talking to someone who doesn't believe in absolute truth, and yet they want to conclude reasonably and logically that there isn't a God. Like, isn't that absurd? If there's no objective truth, then why would you care about reason or logic at all? Reason and logic could be totally different things for me than they are for you, right? Like, if there's no transcendent truth. We all appeal to this transcendent standard that we assume, or at least demand, that everyone else be under as well, but nobody outside of the Christian worldview can give any account of that standard. Like, we all borrow from God. Sometimes by pointing out the absurdity of the unbeliever's actions, like using half of the wood to make an idol, they see their folly, and sometimes not. You know, their worldview has to ultimately be robbed of all meaning. It's really only then that they can consider God, because they have to realize that they acknowledge God already. They have to see the folly in denying him and yet appealing to his standards at all times. That gets people to reconsider it all, you know? But it's ultimately a work the Spirit of God has to do in them. The verses I read say it themselves. The one crafting the idols is blinded and has a deluded heart. He can't acknowledge that he's living a lie, you know? But that's not where God leaves it. God has made a way for them to be redeemed, and for some, he opens their eyes and quickens their hearts. A part of our apologetic method must be praying for the ones to which we're witnessing, and we have to appeal to God to save them. That's going to do it for this week. Short episode this week. Just some quick thoughts I had on that passage as I passed it. I just wanted to thank you all for tuning in. We do have a few 5-star reviews on Apple Podcasts. Let me pull them up real quick. I don't remember the names. That's the thing. Like, I'm pretty sure I know some of these people personally, but they have these wacky usernames on Apple Podcasts, and I never know who they are. GXRIOR said he's listened to almost all the episodes and he's never disappointed, always pleased with the content, looking forward to the next episode. Well, thank you very much. I think I know who you are. Thank you. I appreciate the 5-star review. It helps the show. And another one by NMR70425. See, I can't remember that. I enjoy this podcast. Listening to Nick interview guests and discuss theology is a real treat. Well, thank you again very much. I'm sure one of those two reviews was Chris Jameson, but I'm not sure which one. So thank you if it was. Thank you to those who I'm unaware of. I really appreciate you taking the time to do that. It's a free thing. but it does take time and effort, and I always appreciate it when people go out of their way to do something to benefit the show. Even if it's free to them, it still takes time and effort, so thank you. I think that's going to do it. So I've been your host, Nick, here to tell you not to use your wood for idols. And if you're as committed to Christ's victory as I am, I'll be here to do it with you all again next week. Goodbye for now.